This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, I'm not really a beach guy. I don't need the salt water up my nose, the sand all up in, you know, everywhere. If I'm going to get a sunburn, if it's absolutely necessary to be out on the water, I think I'd rather go fishing. But a couple of years ago, I went to the shore with a friend and a colleague, the great journalist and lifelong surfer, William Finnegan. Bill had just published a memoir called Barbarian Days, and it later won the first Pulitzer Prize, I'm pretty sure, ever given to a book about surfing. So it was suggested to me that I meet up with William Finnegan on the water. And by the way, David, you're going to have a great surfboard just for you, and Bill's going to give you a lesson. Fantastic idea, right? Did we mention that you're going to go at the crack of dawn on a Sunday?
Look at this. I mean, nobody can surf, but look at the waves. Wow.
I'm sitting out on the beach with the great Bill Finnegan.
Oh,
see that?
Oh.
Let's try that again. That was quite a wipeout. I'm sitting out at the Atlantic.
Look at that stance. Wow. Oh.
I'm David Remnick, and I'm here with my friend and colleague, Bill Finnegan, who's written an astonishing book called Barbarian Days. And we're sitting out here in the Rockaways at the Atlantic, watching a lot of people fall in the water as they try to surf.
There are probably more than 100 people in the water. And the waves are kind of nice. They're small and quick. And one of the odd things about this crowd is that there are no clumps of people where the waves are concentrating, because nobody out can read the water at all. Nobody's reading the waves. And you actually read the waves first before you ride them. I read these as pretty good, with a couple of good spots to take off.
The water looks so nice, I want to go dive in.
So what we're going to do is we're going to get in the water.
Yeah.
And we're going to attempt to stand on a board.
You're going to catch some waves.
Yeah.
You might be well advised to stay on your belly the first couple.
Okay. That's what I tend to do when I surf.
It's low tide, so it's going to be a little crunchy, a little quick. Let's go west, yeah.
Let's go where it's like maximally dangerous. And you began this adventure in life as a really young kid in Hawaii as a way to do what? As a way to get out of the house?
I grew up playing around in the ocean in Southern California. At a certain point, the age of 10, I really admired surfers and how beautiful what they did seemed, and how cool. This is in the early, mid-60s.
How long did it take you? How many times did it take you before you could get up on a board and surf a wave?
I think the first wave I caught, I stood up and rode for a long time. But I was a small kid.
The first time you went surfing?
Yeah, but I was a small kid on a big board. I spent a lot of time in the water body
surfing.
You're
just trying to make me feel better.
I spent a lot of time in the water body surfing. I could read waves.
Right.
I've been reading them for years, and that's the crucial thing.
And why did it become an obsession? It wasn't just, you know, everybody, when they're kids, they play playground basketball, or they collect model airplanes, or they do what they do. Surfing for you has never been that. How did that start, and why?
Well, surfing is quite different from other sports, and it's not just me, it's for lots and lots of people this happens. It takes a tremendous amount of time to get even halfway decent. I mean, you need to put in basically years during which you have nothing else to do. In other words, you need to be a kid. And once you learn, the pleasure of it is so intense.
What is it? What's the pleasure of it?
Well, riding a wave well, it feels like such an achievement because you know how far you've had to come to do it. There's that. Some waves I caught in Fiji in the 70s off an uninhabited island. A friend and I camped there. We'd kind of heard about a wave, and then we'd seen this wave with binoculars, and it was an absolutely incredible wave. A long, 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 a 300-yard long left over a very shallow coral reef, just going on and on and on, and you're not getting obliterated, not falling
off.
And
in real time, how long does the experience last?
It's probably 10 or 15 seconds, but it feels like forever. I mean, you're in that moment where you are braced for impact, you're about to dive off, and you don't dive off, and you don't dive off.
What are you seeing? What's in front of your eyes?
Well, you're looking down the line. What's the wave going to do? What's the wave going to do? And at a certain point, when you realize that the wave is just going to hold you that deep in the barrel and just fire you like cannon down this reef, you are free to actually look back deeper into the tube. You're free to look up at the wave that's breaking over your head. You're inside, and you're looking at daylight and sky ahead, and that's where you're headed.
Is it roaring or quiet?
It's noisy. I mean, at a certain point in the barrel, people say it gets quiet, and I think I've felt that, but I don't know why it should be true, because the wave's breaking full force all around you.
All right.
First,
here
let's,
we go.
Let's put your leash on. Put it back down.
I have to put a leash on?
Yeah.
This is the third most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life.
So, the two things I told you, it's actually important to remember now.
Board straight.
Straight. Board straight. And second thing I didn't get to finish telling you.
Okay.
Never get your board between you and the wave.
Oh, good you told me that.
You. Yes. It's to the side or behind you.
Good
it's to
tip.
The side or behind you. Never between you and
excellent
the wave.
Excellent tip.
Third
so,
thing.
So the board should always be to your side.
Side or behind you, anywhere but except in front of you. Because it will hit
okay.
you quickly.
Okay, great.
And the third thing, and this is for after you fall off.
Yeah.
This could happen.
Which could possibly happen. Yeah.
Get a good breath if you can before you fall off.
Like uh-huh.
Fill your lungs. And when you
and then
fall in, it's not real deep, it's not a lot of water, but nonetheless, go as deep as you can, go to the bottom, whatever. And then hold your breath and stay down there a little while.
Why?
Because the board is bumping around, you don't want to get hit.
Sake.
And then when you come up, and this is the most important single thing,
yeah.
come up with your arms over your head.
So it's like not
in front of your face, so you don't get hit by your board.
And you think that I'm going to remember all this
yes.
in a moment of crisis?
No, I mean people never do until they get hit a couple times. But
I don't want to get hit any time.
So that's why I think right. you will remember.
All right, let's go.
Okay, let's walk this way a little bit.
Because
right. the current's going that way. We don't want to end up on those rocks.
Okay.
Pretty little waves.
You know, Bill, I've read your book a couple of times, and I cannot help but thinking this guy has had more fun in about 3 weeks of life than I've had in a lifetime. There are different ways of living lives. You know, that Milan Kundera book, Lightness and Heaviness, the heaviness
uh-huh.
of responsibility, and there's the lightness of living outside, trying to live away from that.
Yeah.
And you've done both. You know, as a reporter, you've been in the middle of the worst circumstances all around the world. And then you do this. How does one treat the other?
It's a good description. I mean, I have this sort of bipolar life, and the North Pole of irresponsibility is surfing. You know, dropping everything. It's nature worship. And you have to be ready, if you're going to surf, to like ditch all engagements and flee your desk and make all kinds of bogus excuses to editors while you chase the waves when they're there.
But you did it for years at a time.
Yeah, I don't know. If you've got the time and money, you just go. And I just went. You know, like dog whistle orders from on high. And I went to the South Seas, Australia, Southeast Asia, Africa, looking for waves.
And nothing was tugging you back. Parents, friends, money, whatever it is. Nothing was dragging you back to...
Well, ambition was. I mean, I felt like, you know, everybody was getting on with life except me. I'm laying here with malaria in Sumatra. You know, what's why am I doing this? My parents got fed up with it after about two or maybe 2.5 years. They just showed up in Cape Town where I was teaching high school. Enough was enough, you know. I mean, they'd had like a few phone calls for me in 2.5 years. It's not that I didn't remember them, but
you never get bored of it.
Bored with waves?
Yeah.
Not when the waves are good.
And so there's always the lure of the possibility of the waves.
Right, and the waves are usually not good, and you spend a huge amount of time chasing good, uncrowded waves.
All right, here we go.
It's fairly cold.
I didn't exactly grow up in a beach family.
Go ahead and lay down on it. I'll push you out. Good. Good. Go ahead and lay down.
Get on it?
Yep.
My usual experience of the ocean in New York City is when I would go with my grandmother after visiting my great-grandmother to Coney Island. And she would just yell at me and say, "Watch out for the syringes."
You're okay. Don't paddle. Don't paddle. Don't paddle.
What is it in your personality that makes surfing part of you?
I have been surfing so long that it's probably...
It is your personality.
...formed my personality to some extent. And anyway, all kinds of personalities surf, you know.
Right, I was going to say, you're not Mr. Laid Back. I mean, it's not like some cartoon of a surfer. And as a writer and as a reporter, you couldn't be more ferocious and aggressive in your own way.
I think I'm the same person surfing and reporting. I'm fairly intense in the water. I really want to surf. I take some chances. I've had lots and lots of arguments with the guys I surf with. No, we shouldn't paddle out here. I'm paddling out, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of all of a piece.
So you're the guy, when I go out reporting in some place, you're the guy who says, no, we're going to the next checkpoint.
Yeah, okay. I fear so.
Okay, fair enough. Tell me about danger. What's the catalog of your injuries?
Wow, I'm talking about danger. I'm watching people crash into each other out here who just
starting
don't
to get
know
more crowded,
what
isn't
they're
it?
Doing. Yes, and people not hanging onto their boards. So the main danger is
starting to look like the Belt Parkway on the ocean.
Yes, it is. So the main danger is other people's surfboards, I'd say. With me, I mean, yeah, I have lots of little injuries, of concussions, broken nose, you know, broken this and that, but...
What do you mean, broken this and that?
I don't know. My ankles are a mess. It seems like everything that's wrong with me is from surfing, but most of it's long term. It's my eyes are messed up from the glare. I've got these pterygia in both eyes. My ears are really messed up from cold water. I've had 3 operations. My skin is a mess. I'm always having this basal cell carcinoma dug out, and I hope it remains only like that.
Have you ever been terrified?
Yes.
Where?
In Hawaii, in Madeira.
What's the terrifying bit?
For me, the worst moments have been in really big waves. Last year in Hawaii, I did something stupid. I was on too small a board in big waves at a place called Makaha in Hawaii. And I got frustrated because I was on a small board, it was hard to catch waves. So I moved in. I sat too far in. I sat in a really dangerous spot, and I paid the price. I got held down for a very long time by a couple of big waves. And I've actually taken a solemn vow not to do anything that stupid again.
You want your daughter to surf?
No.
She's how old now?
13.
And you've never kind of done with her what you just did with me?
I've pushed her into little waves.
Is she suitably terrified?
Not bad. I mean, I even took her out to her mother's distress before she could swim. I took her out in Costa Rica and rode some waves.
Whoa. You took her out surfing before she could swim?
It was totally safe. she had one of those little things around her. Little floaty things. I had a death grip on her leg. She was not going to fall off. The waves were small. We were on a big board. But it was taken ill by my wife and others.
Can't imagine why.
Yeah. But then she and I, in Hawaii one time, were out on a giant tandem board, like, riding together. We've done that a few times, you know, ridden together just on our bellies, me and back. And I made a mistake, and we had a really big board, like an 11-foot board.
She got smacked.
And had her dad land on her from a height. And then hold her under for a little while his legs were tied up by a leash, and it was generally pretty rough and traumatic, and she hasn't surfed since, I don't think.
Get ready to slide back a little bit. You did a great job of staying under after you ate it.
I'm really good at failure.
I mean, you were in no danger because your board was outside of you. But okay. In principle, you gotta just...
You're gonna let me know when there's a wave coming, right?
Yeah. Wave coming, right?
I'm okay. Trying to be more careful. Always make sure I get back to shore. That's the main thing. Yeah.
Jesus Christ! Now you have to stand up on the thing. I think I'm hooked. I'm ready to go to Tahiti or wherever.
This book is a memoir, and it uses surfing as a vehicle, as a way of living, and when you look back on all the time you've spent in the water and thinking about surfing, it seems to me like it's like physical chess in a way. It's meaningful and meaningless at the same time, right?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's the most useless thing you could possibly do. It's just a monomaniacal pastime and really doesn't resemble sport. There's nobody keeping score. You'd rather do it alone, usually, although there's a performance aspect.
You want to be seen?
Yes, you want to be seen. You want to do it well. You want to do it stylishly. That's important.
And it has to do with masculinity?
Not necessarily. Some women surf beautifully, but it's...
I meant your own masculinity.
Well, it's certainly, especially in bigger waves, more challenging waves, it's a continual proving ground, yes.
When do you stop?
I have no plans to stop. I do know guys who surf into their 80s, obviously on bigger boards and gentler waves, and they
on lakes.
Try to find some wave to yeah. grow old. Some way to grow old gracefully.
I mean, to watch Bill do it, even on a small wave out in Far Rockaway, and nobody else is getting up on their boards for more than a half a second, and Bill at age 60-something, just rides the thing in with ease all the way in. That's pretty amazing. There he goes. Oh my God.
William Finnegan's memoir, Barbarian Days, won the Pulitzer Prize. In a minute, we'll travel up the shore a couple of hundred miles to another famous beach spot. But instead of surfers, this one's got pilgrims. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm David Remnick. The actress Parker Posey has been in so many great movies, Dazed and Confused, Clock Watchers, The House of Yes, Best in Show, my favorite, A Mighty Wind, and now she's written a memoir. Our fearless entertainment reporter Michael Shulman went to spend a little time with Parker Posey not long ago, and in fact, he got a little more time than he bargained for.
Oh my God. Did you lock the door? Okay.
Are we seriously locked out here?
Parker Posey next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Have you ever boosted someone over a wall?
Kristen Rupanian has published exactly one story in The New Yorker, but it was a gigantic blockbuster. It was called Cat Person. It's about an online relationship that leads to a date that goes horribly wrong. It landed in the midst of the Me Too movement, and Cat Person didn't just touch a nerve, it grabbed the nerve and pulled. And then Rupanian quickly found herself not only in the midst of controversy, but with a considerable book deal. Rupanian comes from Plymouth, Massachusetts, and if that name rings a bell, and it should, it's where the Pilgrims landed. Generations of tourists and school kids have been visiting Plymouth Plantation, the living history museum where reenactors practice 17th century crafts and they keep livestock and try to dodge obnoxious teenagers from the 21st century, like Kristen Rupanian.
Oh, there's Ethan.
This place was a staple of my childhood, but not necessarily in the same way that it was for people who came in just to go on the tour and learn from the actors. I had friends who, as teenagers, did work here. I would come here on school trips, and I would kind of sneak in is the most dramatic way of putting it, but wander around when I was a teenager. My favorite thing to do when I was a kid, and we would come into the main village and talk to the historical reenactors, was to try and trick them. It was like an endless game, if you grew up in Plymouth, to see if you could get them to say something that would reveal that they were not, in fact, from the 1600s. And we never succeeded. I mean, they have an encyclopedic amount of knowledge, and they will not crack, no matter how hard a 12-year-old tries to get them. So now we're heading down into Plymouth Plantation, into the village, so we're gonna see that and poke around and see if we can trick in any pilgrims into acknowledging they know what an airplane is.
And then we spent about another month or so at Cape Cod, about 5 weeks, trying to figure out where we should...
This is, I guess, important to note. In the village, they play actual characters. So it's the Alden family, the Standish family, the Winslow family, representing the actual people there. When I was probably 10, I participated in... I want to call it the Pilgrim's Progress. I'm not sure if that's exactly right, but it was essentially a parade where I was a small child and I had a historical identity. I was a young boy, and what I knew about myself was that I was a troublemaker who eventually ran away and joined for a brief period the Wampanoags and then came back and was hanged. So that was a vivid, vivid moment for me, and I walked proudly down the streets pretending to be that young man. Let's see, maybe in here it looks like a bunch of people are leaving. I always feel a little shy talking to them.
So if you want to think of it this way, this is a bedchamber over here.
Hi. So could you tell us a little bit about yourself? What's your name? What are you up to right now?
Oh, right now I'm mostly just, I've come in from the garden, so I'm just resting at the moment, but deciding what to cook.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have kids?
Any girls?
Children.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, 5 in total, but only 2 that are living here right now. I've got 2 sons and a stepson that is still in England.
Can I ask you a question? Do you know what this is?
Does it belong to you?
Yes.
Oh, then it don't matter to me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
So long as you know what it is, okay. then it don't mind me.
Cool. That's all. All right, let's go there. Bye, it was really nice to meet you.
You also.
I showed her a cell phone. So I felt very much like a 12-year-old doing that.
This is like a really peaceful section where you can feed goats.
So now we're walking down a path. There's a very distinct smell to the area around here that I think is a mix of campfire smoke, the animals, manure, and then the ocean is right here too. So yeah, the smell of this air brings back a lot of memories for me. And it's beautiful. Chipmunk. Chipmunk just ran adorably across our path.
Wampanoag people drink water and tea daily, every day.
Okay, so this is the Wampanoag home site, and what they do here is they try to convey what it was like for the Wampanoag at the time when the pilgrims arrived and slightly before.
You're welcome, you guys have a good day.
There's what looks like a grass dome style house over there, and then a few, I would call them lean-tos, that are made out of sticks and looks like dried grass.
So the spit is pine.
So there's two women, staff, who are weaving something, it looks like weaving a bag, and roasting some fish over a fire. And they're very knowledgeable about all the kind of little details of life in terms of the materials that were used, the food that they used, the process. Do you want to hear what they're saying?
So for these, you can use a dip net, but you had specialized tools for fishing for both the river and the ocean. You had hook, line, and sinker.
They're wearing traditional Wampanoag clothes and shoes, and they're sitting on some skins. That is a vivid sense memory I have too from being a kid and coming here and seeing the skins for the first time and being both fascinated and kind of heartbroken and repelled. My mother bought me a rabbit skin, I think, at one of the stores here, and I loved it because it was so soft but felt endlessly guilty about it. One thing I remember is that while the pilgrims pretend to be from the time that they're meant to represent, the Wampanoag just talk to you fairly straightforwardly about their lives while at the same time teaching the people who visit some sort of basic things about hunting and gathering and home building and things like that. The older I got, the more complicated I understood that it was. It's not until you leave home, right, that you start thinking about where did the place that I come from shape me, and it occurred to me how funny it was that I had come from a place that is so obsessed with its own history and has such a specific narrative about how this history relates to the history of the country as a whole. I think the goal is to try and give a version of the country's history that is sort of touristic enough that it draws people and that people come and want to have a nice day, but that maybe gives you just enough that you might start picking back at it and asking harder questions. And I feel like in that sense, like, it did work for me in terms of shaping the way that I think about history as stories, right? Like, not everybody thinks about it like that. Like, you might grow up thinking that history is just a set of facts, and I think they do you can't grow up here and sneak into the village and try and trick historical reenactors into telling you the truth without getting that everybody's telling you a story, you know?
Fiction writer Kristen Rupanian at Plymouth Plantation, the living history museum in Plymouth, Massachusetts. That's it for right now, and I want to thank you for joining us as always. We have a podcast episode up every Tuesday and Friday, so please don't miss it. And if you don't mind, take a second and rate the show on whatever platform you use. It's always appreciated.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Avi Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Michael Lee Rao, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Yeh, with help from Trent Williamson, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.